Hi everyone, welcome back to Historical Friction, a podcast about retelling the past and reframing the present through pop culture and fiction. This is Helen, your resident feral Victorianist, and for this episode, Abigail and Sarah are going to drag me all the way back to the 10th century with The 13th Warrior, a 1999 film adaptation of Michael Crichton's novel Eaters of the Dead. In this film, an Arab ambassador, played in some classic 90s cultural appropriation by Antonio Banderas, joins a Viking raiding party to defeat a mysterious supernatural enemy. This is basically a 90s cheesy horror action flick, so it doesn't come with major content warnings, but as I mentioned, that cultural appropriation is something to keep in mind for this episode. As always, you can find us on Twitter, at History Friction. Our podcast is also on Patreon, where you can subscribe to receive our monthly digests. Patreon is where we share favourites and recommendations and expand upon chat that happens on the show. There's artwork and pet pictures. It's a general good time. Our Patreon enables us to improve the podcast and keep creating better content. We're so thankful to all our patrons for your support. If you feel like signing up, you'll be just in time to read our new digest for the month of June. Thanks everyone. Enjoy the show.
Hello, dear listeners. We have a treat for you today. We're going to be talking about the 1999 just Antonio Banderas vehicle, The 13th Warrior. How do you guys feel about the hour and 48 minutes that you spent on this?
I feel like I went on a rollicking wild ride that was simultaneously really boring. It was like if an educational animatronic diorama at a museum went at 100 miles per hour.
That's such an interesting comment, because this film is based on the 1974 book by Michael Crichton called The Death Eaters, although The Eaters of the Dead, which is written as a fake academic edited text, where there's it's supposedly like the lost Abd Bid Fadlan manuscript, and then there's like tons of footnotes and stuff, and then in the footnotes is all like arguing about the translations of certain words. So this being a fairly dull educational film, kind of, you know, it has the same, it's in that vein.
That's so interesting that in the original source text there was almost like an overarching editorial voice, because in a sense I feel like that was what was bafflingly missing from the film itself. It is something that simultaneously tries to take this interestingly pseudo-factual approach. This, I think it's described as a plausible historical fiction in the Wikipedia. Yet it incorporates all these kind of high fantasy aspects that really don't make a lot of sense and are just like really disorientating to watch.
Yeah, I came to the film only having read a very short thing that said that it was based on the Crichton book, which I had no knowledge of and did not go and look into any further, and Beowulf. Those were the only two things that I knew. So I was like, oh, so it's going to be like a fantasy, because Crichton did Jurassic Park and a lot of other sci-fi kind of stuff. So this will be obviously something very fantastical. And then Beowulf, which of course is an epic fantasy. Like, you think of it in the fantasy, not the this could really have happened realm. So the whole time, I just kept waiting for something supernatural to show up. And they set it up like something supernatural is going to show up. And then they were like, it's just men. And I was like, oh, what?
Yeah, that was one of the, it was a bit of an anticlimax. I was also really looking for a monster.
Yes. Yeah, so should we maybe do a brief overview of the plot?
Let's.
Such as it is, let's do it.
So it starts with our hero, Abd Ibn Fadlan, is sent in to... my cat is like getting tangled in my headphones.
Welcome, small creature.
Yeah, she's a nightmare, but she's very beautiful, so should we forgive her for it? Anyway, our hero has an affair with a woman, and as punishment is sent as an ambassador to the north, where he encounters the Volga Vikings, or the Varangarians. The Varangians, but he's like, they never say who they are, like, they just call them Northmen, right? He sees a Viking funeral. Another messenger comes from further from the north, and warns and asks them for help because they're being attacked by some sort of mist creatures. A wise woman tells them they need 13 warriors. Our hero, played by Antonio Banderas, is the 13th one, and they travel north. And that's how it really sets it up.
Yeah, that's, I mean, and as far as I'm concerned, that's basically the whole plot. It was really, watching it, I realized that what I didn't connect with on it was that I had no idea who any of the characters were, except for Antonio Banderas, but even him I didn't really care about. I couldn't tell anybody else in the film apart besides him. They all just looked the same and had no real distinguishing characteristics. I was kind of like, oh, I think that's the king one. This is the other blonde one who's a good fighter, and then the redheaded guy. And then when he fought a different redheaded guy, I was very confused for a minute because I was like, isn't he with them? And then I was like, oh, no, apparently that's a different redheaded guy.
This happened to me too, and I was like, why are they fighting their own guy? What kind of insane double bluff is this? And then the redheaded guy number two turned around, and I realized, oh, it's a different man who incidentally, I don't know in what accent redheaded man number two was speaking, but they overdubbed every single part of his dialogue, so it must have been utterly incomprehensible.
Yeah, I also...
I had not noticed.
I couldn't tell a single one of them apart, and it wasn't until afterwards, when I went to look at like what the characters' names were, that I was able to kind of pick them out. Which is quite... like, it's... it's almost impressive that they've managed to make them so interchangeable.
Yes.
They travel north, and where they're attacked by what seems to be supernatural creatures that are possibly eating humans. There is, like, they walk through this charred and burnt up village where, like, all the human corpses have been gnawed on or whatever, and they find a little Venus of Willendorf figure. The little stone figures of a female body with, like, the female characteristics, like, very exaggerated, so big hips and big boobs, and in this case, decapitated.
I was fascinated by the fact that they just so blatantly borrowed the Venus of Willendorf and projected this sort of very simplistic anthropological fetish onto that statue. I kind of was like the Leonardo DiCaprio pointing meme. I was like, Venus of Willendorf, Venus of Willendorf, I know what that is.
Yeah, but I feel like that's what you're supposed, that's how you're supposed to interact with that scene.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, it's some heavy foreboding. They get attacked. They realise that they're not being attacked by monsters. They're in fact being attacked by humans. There's another old wise crone who might be the same one that we've seen earlier, but I think I suspect.
I was confused. Yeah, I think it's a new one.
There's an abundance of crones.
If you count Omar Sharif's character Melchizedek as one of the crones, then there's three separate plot exposition crones in this film to move events forward.
Yeah, that's an interesting. Like, that's too many. I feel like you're allowed one.
I just feel like, yeah, the phrase abundance of crones really shouldn't be used ever. And if we get merch, I think we just need to get merch that says abundance of crones.
That's the collective noun for a group of crones and abundance.
Yeah, also like us, the host of this podcast.
We are an abundance of crones.
I love that.
Anyway, so the crone number three tells them that they need to kill the mother and the ones that wear the horns of power. They then travel into this underground cave slash river system where they encounter a fucking ton of heads and bodies suspended in a root system. And, like, again, this is the most fucked up scene in this entire film. A massive Venus of Willendorf figure surrounded by hundreds of human skulls, just sort of drifts of human skulls in this system.
So could we have maybe a brief explanation of what the Venus of Willendorf is? Because I had no idea what that was until you all started talking about it. So it was not a figure that I recognized or have any history on. And I hope that I'm not the only one out there, but listeners might want some background.
Yes, very good idea.
I definitely do.
So the Venus of Willendorf is a I should probably have looked up the dates for it now, but it's one of several figures depicting the human body, the female body, where certain characteristics like breasts and hips are really exaggerated. It has at times been described as like pornographic images, and is one of the classic ones that people will say is used for ritual purposes.
Yes.
But there has been some scholarship recently that has kind of unpicked this a little bit and looks at things like art historians did a project where they took photos of their own bodies looking down and realized that if you don't have access to mirrors, and this is like how you would portray your own body, so that the figure might actually be one of the very first sort of self-portraits, or it might be about surviving childbirth, because that's, you know, really dangerous, or it might be testament to like a prehistoric mother goddess type cult.
It's one of those artifacts which it has the capacity for many different meanings to be projected onto it, because it is one of the earliest sort of forms of human, and specifically like female anatomy representation in art that we have. So multiple different, you know, cultures and historians have projected different narratives onto this figure, which partly is kind of what enables it to kind of serve this like fetish goddess function in this film, because it is kind of like, it simultaneously works as a symbol just kind of in general, taken to be a sort of like anthropological artifact. But if you happen to have a background knowledge or even just like a familiarity with the symbol, then you can kind of turn around and go, oh, someone's adding their interpretation of the Venus of Willendorf onto all the other ones pre-existing. So it kind of like, it sets up some inherent or some like mnemonic meaning to it, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
for sure.
I think in this case, it's putting this figure in a really, because this is, you know, a murdering, like, some sort of cult that's all centered on this one figure. It's almost, and we will come back to talk a little bit about Grendel later on, but it's just such a weird, for me, it's such a weird choice, because it's like, what are you trying to say about like matrilineal and matriarchal societies?
Mm-hmm. And especially because there was a part of me when I saw that they were opting for this very specific statue image, I really wanted their female, their mother goddess character to be a fat, round Venus of Willendorf shaped, powerful goddess, monster, villain type. And the character that they selected for this is like this scrawny, frightened looking little girl, or very, very small women. And so it kind of robs that scene of some of, like, the female character's power, I thought, because she looks so frail and so vulnerable, at least to my eyes, and then she's immediately stabbed and cut down by the Beowulf character.
Yeah, but not before she scratches him with, like, a weird sort of fake nail claw thingy.
Yes, which, when that scene happened, so... picking up the plot a little again, yeah, they are in this river system surrounded by skulls, and then the battle scene happens between them and the what they've started terming bear men, and the king Northman, one of the three I could kind of distinguish, finds the mother goddess bear person, and like Helen said, she's kind of scrawny and scared looking, but she has this very prominent claw and she scratches him with it, and I'm assuming it was like, oh, the claw had poison on it, and so now he's getting really sick, but that's never explicitly stated as far as
she has a snake around her neck, and she very briefly dips the claw into a little cup. And I think that's supposed to be our visual clue that she's about to poison him.
I see. I must have been looking down writing notes at that
point. It is a blink and you'll miss it moment for sure.
Yeah.
So they escape. It's a very daring escape, I think, as well, where they just decide to swim. Like, assuming that they will be able to make it out and not just drown underneath this cave system. But, you know, needs must. They escape. The Mead Hall is attacked by again by what is known as what they call here is the Wendels, but what is Grendel? And they defeat him, and then the Beowulf character dies from the poison having been scratched, but not before asking our hero to write down his story for him. So, yeah. It was, at least it wasn't very long. Nice.
Yeah, it was compact.
You always know the marker of a good film is when you can comment on the time positively. Like, yeah, I may have been counting every second of watching this, but it wasn't very long.
It was also not paced particularly well. I definitely looked... I'd been watching for a while, and I kept thinking, I wonder when the main plot will start. I wonder when the main plot will start. And I looked over at the playtime left, and I had 25 minutes left in the film. And I was like, oh, I've been watching the main plot. That's bad.
But do you guys know, so the Ahmed Ibn Fadlan was a... I think the early parts of this film is essentially based on his story, and it's was an ambassador sent to the newly converted parts of the Islamic world to teach them about like Islamic legal doctrine, essentially. And while he's out there, he meets the Volga Vikings, and he writes down a bunch of his experiences. And there's no like full manuscript that survives that describes his encounters. A lot of them are, you know, produced, like the written sources that exist are about a couple of hundred years after, but they seem to be fairly faithful copies of the original because they crop up in different places. And then there's the story of Beowulf. And I can't remember what any of the characters' real names are in this film, so I'll just keep referring to them as their Beowulf names, because that's very clear what they were supposed to be. But do you guys know the story?
Could you give us a bit of background? Because I know the basics of the story. I know about Grendel and Grendel's mother, but I know that there's more to it than that.
Yes.
What I think is important, though, is that in this case, so in the poem, Beowulf is asked to go north and to go to this other place to help. To help the king, who's being attacked by Grendel, who is like a supernatural giant monster, a son of Cain, etc. He goes off, kills Grendel, and as revenge, Grendel's mother comes and attacks him, and he has to kill her as well. Later on, at a separate part of the story, he fights a dragon, who he wins the battle against the dragon, and then is cut by the dragon, is poisoned by the dragon's claw or whatever. So what we see in this film is that they've kind of combined the two heroic fights, or the three heroic fights, into one, but they kind of swap them around so that Grendel's mother and the dragon is like the same character, essentially.
And they've tried to create a real life kind of historical context for the origins of those stories, which kind of falls flat because it's simultaneously realist and supernatural.
Yeah, I thought that was one of the weirdest things, like, because if you have a monster, then, you know, that's all, you don't have to explain, like, the logistics of where do all of these monster creatures live. You just have a monster, and it lives in the swamp. But now, you have all of these other people. But that was not the only sort of weird semi-supernatural moment. Shall we talk about how, you know, languages are acquired in this film?
Oh, it had some very strong Grandmother Willow from Pocahontas vibes, in which Grandmother Willow basically says, listen with your heart, in the Disney animated version, and Pocahontas can suddenly speak English fluently with John Smith. I was like, oh, this film just borrowed from Pocahontas a couple years earlier. I mean, they tried to make it seem like Antonio Banderas learned the Norse language over the course of maybe a few weeks, but he just like sat around the fire listening to them tell stories and suddenly was completely fluent, and it was sort of a magical moment.
Yeah, I don't know. Are we supposed to understand that it was magical, or is it just that people, that he just acquired a language over the course of their journey?
The way I interpreted it was actually kind of the opposite of that, which was it is supposed to be a factual representation of language acquisition over time, which spectacularly failed because of the filming style that they used. So there is the implication that this is happening over multiple nights, because you see different kind of weather slapping Antonio Banderas in the face. Unfortunately, because they've set up these scenes as all happening around the same campfire, even though the weather changes as it slaps Antonio Banderas in the face, the lighting, the framing, and even the positions of the actors are continually all within the same setup, which really gives the visual impression that this is all happening over the course of one night. You really have to think about it to realise that this is actually supposed to be happening over a long period of time.
Oh, I definitely thought it was happening over several weeks or even months. Like, I got that that's what they were trying to set up, but they sort of, like, made everything hazy in, like, a dream kind of way with the filming. And, like you're saying, everybody was in the exact same location with different weather. And I was like, this just, it feels like a magical language acquisition.
Yeah, I was still reeling from the scenes in the beginning where Antonio Banderas and Crone One are trying to interact with this group of like foreigners, and Antonio says to his Crone, try Greek, at which point he starts speaking Latin and with like the occasional Greek word thrown in, and it's really cheap to hire a poor like graduate student or like postdoc to just get some real language in there. You don't have to do like a Google Translate and pick up, like, there was that, and then there's the other bit where they don't try to, and okay, fine, like, I'm not gonna say that you have to try to do some sort of Old Norse or whatever, but they do this sort of pan-Scandinavian language thing that I don't know if you pick up on unless you speak one or more of those languages. But there's a bunch of people who speak like Icelandic, and then the crone number two is clearly speaking Swedish, and then they all just have speak different Scandinavian languages. But I don't think that really matters. It's just a sort of alien, barbaric.
I'm really glad you clarified that, actually, because I have learned a microscopically small, but a very little bit of Swedish to get around, like, because I'm interested in it. And so when I watch sort of Viking-themed content or any kind of Scandinavian-themed content that has, like, Swedish in it, I am picking up on it subconsciously and trying to recognise it. So I knew just enough while listening to this to know that it was very strange and not Swedish but had components of Swedish in it, and that suddenly that makes a lot more sense.
I was trying to figure out if the actors were like just speaking their native tongues but I don't think that's even what happened, and then I couldn't tell any of them apart. So
Tony Curran speaking broad Glaswegian as his native tongue.
I mean, look, I would have been in favour of that.
Yes.
Shall we talk about the costumes and the styling and all of that stuff? He is a handsome man and he looks good with a little bit of black eyeliner, but was it strictly necessary?
I kind of feel like the black eyeliner was a stand-in, almost as if to make an excuse for the fact that they didn't cast an actual Arab actor to play this Arab character. They were like, let's just put eyeliner on the exotic Antonio Banderas and it will do the same job.
Yeah, it definitely had some feelings of trying to exoticize a European man that they cast as an Arabic man. It was a choice. It reminded me of Cal in Titanic, who they also put eyeliner on, although that character was supposed to be evil, so I wasn't sure what they were doing with that. Also had some resonances with Aladdin from the early 90s. So it definitely had a very 90s vibe. But and I know that we weren't caring, like, people weren't as attuned to casting choices in 1999 as they would be now. Thank goodness they are now. But the idea of casting a European, I mean, I get that he's Spanish and I get that Spain has an Islamic history, but casting a European guy who has ties to the Catholic Church, even though he, I think, now says he's agnostic, just felt really weird to cast him as a devout Muslim of Arabic descent.
Oh, Hollywood has not learned.
Didn't, like, Jake Gyllenhaal play the Prince of Persia, like, only 12 years ago?
Oh, no, did he?
Like, I feel like you're giving Blockbuster Hollywood feels like a lot more credit than they deserve when you say that this is not the kind of thing that they would do now.
Well, they might, but they would definitely get pushback from it because this film didn't bomb because of the casting choices. Like, nobody was like on any news station, because we didn't have social media or anything. Nobody was out there going like, they should absolutely not have cast Antonio Banderas. Whereas now you would at least get people saying like, this is a terrible casting choice.
This was very much the peak time in which Antonio Banderas was considered the, like, heavy air quotes, exoticized hero of cinema in general. Yeah. And I feel like they just picked him because they were like, this is a character that is an other. Antonio Banderas can be an acceptable version of an other while still being comfortably westernized and European enough that we're not actually going to have to deal with any people of colour.
Yeah, but there's an interesting thing that happens in how he is styled throughout as well. So in the beginning, he wears fairly traditional, what we're supposed to think is fairly traditional dress. And then he encounters these Vikings, he goes on, travels with them, And then it becomes more and more sort of naturalized into their like band of brothers or whatever, and starts fighting. He stops wearing, his traditional robes and just has this like bloody torn shirt that is the only thing that he wears, and no more black eyeliner until the very last scene where he puts his hood back on and like. I think he's back in the eyeliner.
Yeah, I found that really interesting because he did, in fact, wear the robes and the turban look until, I think, after their first battle. And then that's when, and I think that's why he had the bloody shirt, because he got it bloody in the battle. But then everybody else looked like they changed clothes. And he, like, just kept on this bloody shirt. And I was like, surely we can do something about this. But yeah, I found it really interesting, like, how over time they tried to make him look, quote unquote, more like the Viking characters.
Yeah, I think that's really, like, he becomes assimilated into this Northman lifestyle and then just sort of rolls with it.
Which I don't think is necessarily, like, a horrible thing, because it feels sort of like what an early anthropologist would do, you know, like if you read like Clifford Geertz and he's trying to like get into like thick description and like gets in with the people who are running from the police when the cockfighting is broken up. That's like a deep cut on Clifford Geertz. But like it does have some of that feel with like he's this anthropologist, especially because they are so interested in his being able to write, or at least the king is really interested in his being able to write throughout. So it seems like he's almost there to chronicle it and to like get into their heads. Like one thing that I really found fascinating about this film is that at the beginning, when Antonio Banderas's character cannot understand the Northmen, we're seeing these characters through his eyes. And so they have the white manly man America, even though they're not American, but like that sort of like masculine idea and we're seeing it through Antonio Banderas's eyes, and what it is violent, deeply unhygienic, and just like very crass and coarse and uneducated compared to everything that he would have known. And I was like, this is fascinating that they're actually showing how it looks from the outside, and we are now positioned as outsiders, as like a westernized audience watching this. But then it didn't really like follow through very well with that idea, because then it just was sort of like, oh, actually, like there's a few good things maybe about his culture, but we never actually got to see his culture.
I actually think, and I feel like I might be about to give this film a whole lot of credit it doesn't deserve, but if we look at the source material for these two, like, so the Chronicle of the Volga Vikings and Beowulf are two very different texts, and the early parts of this film and the first book draws very heavily on the, like, on these sources, where he talks about, you know, he sees he's an eyewitness to a burial where there's a human sacrifice, and he also complains a lot about how unhygienic people are and how there was just like bone everywhere and in front of people, and he's like deeply grossed out about this. So I think that's the thing, and I agree, I think that's quite interesting that you kind of see this culture shock, and it's two cultures meeting, and it's outside of sort of Western Europe, so we're decentering, that's being decentered in a way that I think is quite interesting. And then when we get to Beowulf's narrative, it's just all of that just falls to one side, and he is just a part of this group of people, and there is like never any sort of conflicts that arise from that, or they never have problems understanding each other, because now that he is fluent, that's it. Like, he doesn't, like, he knows this language and he'll never have to have anything explained to him ever again.
The whole idea of culture shock just goes away as soon as he's learned the language. And I think what was like frustrating is that particularly in a post 9/11 world, and this came out in 1999, but particularly in a post 2001 world, all of the bad negative traits that the Antonio Banderas character is seeing in the Northmen are traits that Western media has now put on to Arab characters. And I was like, this is really fascinating. And I really wonder, and they're very reverential about his religion. And he talks about Muhammad and he talks about Allah a lot. And they even have a scene where he's doing one of his daily prayers and like praying towards Mecca. And it's really fascinating. And I was a little bit surprised to see it in a film from 1999. And then I remembered, oh, that's before 2001. But I was like, how different maybe could the reaction have been to everything that happened if this film had actually been a huge success? Like, if they'd done it really well and everybody had loved it and had loved this character, would there have been any more empathy or anything for Arab people in the West? I don't know.
I think it kind of comes back to that sort of Pocahontasification, like this kind of like very, very of its time, 1999, quote unquote, post-racial environment in which they attempt a version of this story where complete cultural assimilation is something which is fairly mutual. So they have this scene before like the big climactic battle in which they take down the big bad, where Antonio Banderas' character Ahmad prays his Muslim prayer. And it is sort of looked upon with a great deal of respect by the Northmen characters. And then when the Northmen characters pray their prayer to meet with their families in Valhalla, Antonio Banderas joins in with them and echoes their prayer back to them. And it's treated as this very mutually respectful appreciation of other religions, which is really interesting because, like, the whole principle which Ahmad is operating under, which is the root underpinning of Beowulf's fascination with his writing and a lot of the sort of religious and cultural exchanges that they have, is, like, there is no god but Allah. And then by the end of the film, Antonio Banderas' character is grateful for the idea that these characters will be praying to their multiple god structure religion on his behalf, and this is treated as this very mutually respectful exchange. And I, to me, that was very much of its time, this sort of highly optimistic late 1990s structure in which everyone can get along together, which, you know, is a really beautiful idea and something that we would all like to believe, I'm sure, but is Eivol strangely optimistic for a film like this, which is equal parts action, battle, and horror, and Eivol thinking exactly as you say, Abigail, about like how close we were in that time period to 9/11. It's very striking that it is a broadly positive, albeit very othered and orientalized depiction of Islam and the Arab culture. It is kind of jarring to sort of like think of it in that time frame, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are these other sort of visual markers of otherness, though, like the appearance of these the Eaters of the Dead, or the Wendell people, essentially. So there's a group of them and they wear these bear like outfits and they have dark tattoos or face paints all over them, and they kind of like, they, I don't think any of them ever speak. They don't seem, don't know if they have like a language, and they're very other from and I think one part of that is that they're presented as so much darker. They're human, but so much darker than
they're literally painted black. But what that reads as visually on the screen is like just a black figure, which is highly symbolic, of course.
Yeah, I felt like the one reason that we were supposed to see the Northmen and Ibn, as they call him throughout, because they can't get the rest of his name right. The reason that we were supposed to see those characters being so okay with each other was that they were like the real humans, quote unquote, compared to the whatever, what was it, the Wendels, I think?
Wendel.
It was supposed to be like Grendel, yeah.
It's funny to me because Wendel is like, to me, the name of like an archetypal nerdy dork character. So every time they were like, fear the Wendel, I was like picturing a little guy in Coke bottle glasses, and it was just really fun. Sorry, you were saying.
Oh, no, that's fine. Yeah, no, well, I mean, at first, the Wendels are presented as supernatural. And in fact, I thought that it was going in the supernatural route. And then when they go to track them down when they're in the cave system, right before they enter the caves, Antonio Banderas says, like, wait, there's bear skulls everywhere. And they were wearing bear helmets. They must think that they're bears, but they're really men. And you're like, oh, so they're humans who think they're bears? And I was like, but surely not. Like, surely this is some kind of like religious thing where the bear is their symbol. But then when they actually see a group of them together in the caves, they are not speaking. They're still painted. And it seems like they are just people who genuinely think they're bears. Like, not to kink shame, but kind of like proto furries. And like, I was just like, this is very strange. And I don't know what to make of this, but it seemed like that's why the humans could get together. But yeah, to the point of their like being painted, it made me think of this book by Ebony Elizabeth Thomas called The Dark Fantastic, Race and the Imagination from Harry Potter to the Hunger Games, which came out a few years ago. And in it, she has this bit where she writes, so she's writing to particularly Black people in America, and she writes that when you're watching fantasy, as she did when she was a little girl, you are the alien other, you are the orc, you are the fell beast. The very presence of the dark other in a text of speculative fiction across genre and modes creates a profound ontological dilemma. And this is just like, I just kept thinking of this book, which everybody should read. It's really, really good throughout. And I was like, this isn't fantasy because these are supposed to be real, but it has that dark other element.
I think that's a really good point. I found out today that apparently in the book there is like that there is this thing that these people might be Neanderthals that have like survived, and there's like a little like group of them, but then they all get murdered by these Vikings.
So it's genocide,
which is a really like it's a such a weird thing, and I don't know, maybe I misunderstood, but that's but I think another point about making them real people rather than like humans or Neanderthals, like rather than having them be like a supernatural monster, is that all of a sudden there's like logistical problems, like where do they all live, what do they eat, how are there only men in this group?
Oh yes, to all of this I kept thinking, how are there so many of them? Because it seemed like the kingdom that asked the 13 warriors to come help was supposed to be like some bigger kingdom, and then we get there and it's like five buildings and a really Lord of the Rings kind of feel. Again, Lord of the Rings had not come out yet, but it had sort of like when Aragorn goes in and the king is like insane and like it was like the whole thing. But I was like, if this is supposed to be the major kingdom and it has about 10 people in it, how come there are literally 10,000 bears, bear people? I don't understand.
Because it's treated as being an invasion, right? It's treated as being the new invader that is spontaneously coming to attack this kingdom. But when you visit them in the cave system with the 13 warriors, you realise that they've been gradually excavating this place for what must have been generations and building their enormous giant Venus of Willendorf statue and building up, let's be honest, a pretty hefty bank of skulls. So their civilization must have predated the kingdom that the 13 warriors are supposed to be saving. They were there first. And also, they're not uniformly murdered at the end of the film. They just go into retreat. So I couldn't help but think that once they regroup and establish a new leader and a new mother figure, then the kingdom's just going to have the same problem again, aren't they? This is going to be a skirmish that goes on for a really long time.
Yeah, and they have, like, they've clearly been doing this. Like, they're very successful flesh-eating monster creatures. So they've collected a lot of skulls. Like, I feel like they made a mistake sending them back.
Yeah, it looks like they had the skulls of literally everybody in Europe. Like, I was like, the populations just weren't this big. I don't understand. And to your point about how are they all men, I also had this question where they kept talking about, like, the mama bear. And I was like, is this woman literally all their mothers? Like, is that a supernatural thing? Like, I don't get how she got elected their mother. I just don't understand if this is a Mad Max thing and there's like some wives in another cave. Like, I'm so confused.
I don't think these people have a complex electoral system somehow, Abigail.
No.
And I think another thing that's happened with this switching of the order of events from Beowulf, where the dragon and Grendel's mother becomes the same character. It's like you are not allowed to have a woman be the final boss. So instead of having, you know, Beowulf kill Grendel and then the mother comes to avenge him, you just have, like, she just gets, like, very easily decapitated, but also poisons him a little bit because women are wily or whatever. And then you get the man. So it's like, even as terrible and terrifying monsters, women are less than men in this.
There's only like 5 women in the whole thing. There's one princess, one healer that has some nice sex with Antonio Banderas, and there's 2 crones. And there's Grendel's mother.
What more could you ask for?
Yeah, I thought the, like, jammed in love story, not love story was really weird. It felt like somebody told them that they had to have a love story because that's what all the, like, epic past films had, period pieces like Braveheart and stuff like that. And I felt that it didn't add anything and in fact actively made it worse. And I couldn't tell why. It also at that point, I mean, clearly they were trying to be respectful of Islam, but they were kind of not in the fact that the whole love story thing was also bound up with him drinking alcohol after he says that he, like, doesn't want to drink alcohol. And one of the other Norsemen has, like, this horn, you know, Viking horn of alcohol. And he is seeming to be quoting from the Quran and says that he can't have fermented grapes or wheat. And the guy starts laughing and is like, ha, 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 it's honey. So he drinks it. And I was like, I don't think that, like, Allah or Muhammad wanted a loophole there, but okay, fine. And then the gal comes up who's kind of been like flirting with him for no reason prior to this. And she's kind of like, come on, let's go have sex. And then he doesn't speak to her again afterwards. In fact, he kind of actively just cold shoulders her. And I was like, this feels like, is this 90s purity culture coming through? Was this, I mean, they established at the beginning that he'd had an affair with this other woman back home. So I don't think this was trying to be like, look, he's straight or anything like that, like the 90s tried to do. I was very confused.
Yeah, I think it's very evident that there were lines within this plot that were cut for time. The women yeah. characters get next to no screen time, even though they do get relatively high billing in terms of like who in the cast is like mentioned as being important. And I think also like they were, in a very 90s way, like, trying to, like, amp up the heterosexuality of it all. Because the real, like, joy of this film for me is, like, this is a dude's rock film. This is bros being bros with swords. And they were like, yeah, but we need a lady to kiss him on the mouth. Otherwise, it's not het enough.
Yeah, I don't, like, I don't know, man. I'm very confused. Like, I think that it was very, I think it was supposed to be released like 97, and then had to be completely like recut, and like the author of the book was brought in to help with the recutting of it because it was unwatchable. They had to do like an entirely new score because they felt like it was that bad. And I think there are bits like this that where it comes through where you have someone who's introduced to be some sort of emotionally important character and then is on screen for all of 5 minutes and then never appears again.
Yeah, and you also could see it some in the cinematography where you had these really beautiful, like, sweeping action sequences, and then you had, like, two identical shots that were, like, grainy and zooming in on children running across a field towards the settlement. And I was like, we literally just had that shot with a different kid bloodily running towards the settlement. And it was just, it felt like a mix of too many directors trying to do too many things that we ended up with two grainy shots of hurt children running across a field.
Yeah, I thought I wasn't paying attention, and I was like, oh, I'll just rewind a bit, see. And then I was like, nope, that's right, that's happening. It's just happening again. Another thing I think is, and again, maybe I'm giving the source material too much credit here, but there was this kind of, there's this mention a lot of people being eaten as if, like, they're being cannibalized. And there is one of the monstrous races that appears in texts by Pliny and is copied throughout the Middle Ages is the anthropophagi, which is like these just horrible, like, humanoid creatures that live on the edge of the world, and their main characteristic is that they eat humans. They eat other humans. And a lot of them on medieval world map, you see them sort of appearing in the very, very north behind these two gates that are closed now but will be open at the end of time, and then they will, like, burst forth. So there was a real worry about, like, kind of the cannibal taboo, but also about these people that sort of existed at the edges of the world that would do something as terrible as, like, eating human flesh. And when this started cropping up, I was like, yes, this is like a really interesting thing to be paying attention to in this film, because it was a concern for medieval people that, like, these sort of monsters would come and cannibalize and, you know, eat humans, because that's, you know, it's a very bad thing. But then that just never really came up again. Like, it was just a thing that that they mentioned. And then they saw, like, the literal sea of skulls and, like, just never really commented on it again. They realised they were human, and therefore the fact that they ate other humans wasn't so scary anymore.
It really makes me wish, even though it is a completely ahistorical idea, it makes me wish that the film had done what the book supposedly did and leaned into the notion that the Wendell people were a throwback to Neanderthals. Because even though it is completely ahistorical and doesn't make any sense, in terms of the sort of pseudo-fantastical monstrosity of these characters and their cannibalism and their fur-wearing, bear-worshipping culture, it adds this sort of dimension of sense to it. The idea that someone could simultaneously be human and inhuman, that kind of, like, draws that plot line together, because so much of the issue that we had in terms of, like, orientating ourselves in the story was the hedging of the bets, in the sense that this is a realist story. No, it's a supernatural story. No, it's a realist story and there's actually an explanation for this all along. If we had had some sort of clarity through the filmic medium about these being a different branch of humanity in a very literal sense, I almost feel like the characters would have been easier to understand. And even though it would have been completely ahistorical, let's be honest, this film wasn't really leaning on its historical documentarianism anyway. So we wouldn't have lost that much.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Yeah, so this film, obviously, it was a massive flop. Like, it cost, what, like 180 million or something? And it made 61 million in the box office worldwide. And it has not stood the test of time.
No, though, to be fair, for what a horrible box office flop it was, the film wasn't as bad as I was expecting. So I went in with such low expectations that I actually was like, this wasn't terrible. So it had that going for it, at least.
Yeah, it sips along fairly well.
I mean, again, I didn't know what the main plot was supposed to be, and then it was over. So that's maybe a problem. it was trying to, like, simultaneously do too much and too little. I had no idea the names of the characters. I had no idea the motivations of any of the characters. Once we discovered that the Wendells were human beings, I didn't have any idea of their motivation for attacking the town, unless maybe it's just that there were so many of them and they needed food. And then, like, I didn't understand why the Wendells were so well known across the world that they wouldn't even speak their name aloud because they were such a horrendous evil, but then they were, like, easy to defeat in, like, half a week and they were just human. There was just a lot that didn't make sense. And then they tried to shove in, like, a court political intrigue thing with the other Northmen that I thought was actually going somewhere, but then that went nowhere. And I also didn't understand it because it seemed like the prince was trying to kill his dad, who was old, but then he also was worried that the men that they'd explicitly asked to come help them with the Wendells were trying to steal his throne. And I was like, they're only there because you asked. Like, I don't know. I'm so confused right now. And then that plot line just evaporated after, like, one fight where a guy was beheaded, and that was, like, it.
My hot take is that this was a very bad film, but would have made a very wonderful ride at Universal Studios.
Oh, that's a good point. Was it a Universal film? Because now it's on Disney Plus.
At Disneyland, then.
Yeah, I'd love it as a theme park ride. Maybe that's why it was made. They thought it would make, like, a good ride.
So what, you would, like, go on your little cart through the cave system and there would be a massive Venus of Willendorf and just, like,
you'd be on a Viking boat. It would be a boat ride. So you'd be in the Viking boat,
of course,
a water-based, like, log flume. But yes, I think, like, the cave thing with the massive Venus of Willendorf would be the set piece, like, near the end of the ride. Yeah.
And there would be little animatronic Vikings and animatronic old crones and animatronic Wendells just, brandishing things at you. Oh, no. And then you would go down a big water chute.
Yeah, they could have just made over Maelstrom in the Norwegian part of Epcot and Disney World. They made it a Frozen ride, but I think a 13th Warrior ride would have been way more popular there.
We should have been the marketing execs for this film.
Oh, no.
I have one last question for you. So apparently the book was written because the author thought that he could prove that he could make Beowulf fun and exciting. Like, that was his motivation for writing this book. And having not read a book, having only seen the film, do you think he
succeeded? I didn't realize that Beowulf wasn't already exciting.
I was going to say, isn't Beowulf kind of notoriously fun and exciting, given that it is the archetypal narrative which has survived generations? Like, I think it's a little bit presumptuous of this novel from the 1970s to say that they can trump Beowulf.
They could do it with, like, some sort of literary mockumentary.
Wow. I mean, I do like Jurassic Park, but, ooh, come on, Crichton.
Yeah, who doesn't love Jurassic Park? That is a superior, like, yeah, source material.
Oh, what a
the
great
Jurassic
film.
Parkification of Beowulf.
Yes.
That we never knew we needed and that we never needed.
Do you have any final thoughts?
Watch it for the haircuts. I don't know. Watch it for the haircuts and chainmail and Tony Curran not knowing what accent he has.
Yeah, it makes a lot more sense if you maybe print out the list of characters and little photos of them so you can tell them apart.
So you need to have, like, a conspiracy theory, like, murder board with all the characters and strings between everybody to understand this film.
Yeah, or, like, a little crib sheet, like, just so you can tell the crones apart and all the Vikings, because
they really do.
They look very similar. And I'm Swedish, I'm allowed to say that.